Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
45 are killed in explosions in Nigeria, and Libya's rival factions ramp up a battle for control. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. A Nigerian police official says a pair of explosions in the city of Jos has killed at least 45 people. The Plateau State Police Commissioner told reporters that the afternoon blast today wounded at least 45 others. Witnesses say the blast went off several minutes apart near a bus terminal and a hospital, both located in a busy market area. Meanwhile, there was no immediate claim of responsibility for that attack. Libya's parliament was set to reconvene today as rival factions battle for control of the country. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett reports.
Libyan lawmakers are scrambling to reassert some semblance of control in the face of a challenge by a key military figure, General Khalifa Haftar. Among their proposals, the lawmakers are offering new elections meant to defuse tension. Forces loyal to Haftar, which overran parliament Sunday, vow to press their fight against what they call an illegitimate government, its Islamist allies, as well as regional and Al-Qaeda-affiliated militias. Fighting between Haftar forces and their rivals in the capital Tripoli and the eastern city of Benghazi has left at least 70 people dead since Friday. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
The African Union force in Somalia, AMISOM, has launched new airstrikes aimed at the militant group Al-Shabaab. AMISOM says the attack near the town of Jilib on Tuesday killed more than 50 Al-Shabaab insurgents. Meanwhile, there's been no independent confirmation of the claim. A South African judge has ordered runner Oscar Pistorius to begin psychiatric tests next week to examine whether his mental state made him criminally responsible for fatally shooting his girlfriend. The judge said today that doctors will test Pistorius to evaluate if he was capable of appreciating the wrongfulness of his act. Voters are casting ballots for president in Malawi, where the incumbent leader Joyce Banda is facing stiff challenges in the first democratic test of her rule. She is facing 11 challengers in her bid to win a new term. The Election Commission chairman told VOA that the voting will be credible and transparent, despite some concerns about a new voters list. The Pakistani Taliban claims responsibility for kidnapping a Chinese tourist who was traveling through the country's northwest. VOA's Sharon Bain has details.
According to District Police Chief Sadiq Baluch, the Chinese national had entered the country at the eastern city of Lahore, crossing into Pakistan from India on a tourist visa. From there, he appears to have traveled across the country into Deir Ismail Khan, an area where militants are active in Pakistan's Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. Baluch says the man was kidnapped on Monday. The police chief says he was informed that two men on a motorcycle kidnapped a person traveling on a bicycle. The police gave chase for about 4 hours but lost the trail. They did find his belongings, Baluch said. Sharon Bain, Islamabad.
Russia's defense ministry says its 40,000 army troops near the Ukrainian border have started dismantling their positions. As unrest continued in eastern Ukraine today, neighboring Russia said its forces in the Bryansk, Belgorod, and Rostov regions were preparing to return to their home bases. NATO and U.S. government officials have said they've seen no immediate sign of Russian forces withdrawing after President Vladimir Putin's orders. Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping promised closer bilateral ties during a meeting in Shanghai today. The two leaders oversaw the signing of 49 agreements in fields such as energy, transport, and infrastructure, though no details were given. However, the countries were not able to reach a long-awaited deal that would supply China with billions of dollars of Russian natural gas for 30 years. Nonetheless, President Xi praised his country's ties with Russia, saying the relationship is key to improving each other's international stature. Fighting back tears, India's Prime Minister-elect said today that he will work to fulfill the expectations of the common man as he prepares to take the oath of office on May 26th. Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party won national elections by a landslide, winning a majority in parliament for the first time in India's history. More details at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Malawians voted Tuesday in a poll where 11 candidates are competing to unseat President Joyce Banda, Southern Africa's female head of state. There were problems in the polling in parts of the main city, Blantyre.
That's VOA's Lamek Masina reporting from Blantyre. Details coming up. Also in the news, continued fighting and displacement in the Central African Republic has left tens of thousands of children abandoned. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ivory Coast, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, donor nations have pledged an additional $600 million in humanitarian aid for South Sudan. The announcement was made at a funding conference in Oslo. Representatives of 40 governments joined officials from UN agencies and NGOs to raise funds to prevent another famine in Africa. The $600 million will be added to $536 million previously pledged. The new total, however, is about $7 million less than UN officials recently said was needed. Donations will provide emergency supplies of food, clean water, medical care, and shelter for about 5 million civilians affected by the war. Libya's embattled parliament was set to reconvene today as rival factions battle for control of the fractured country. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Libyan lawmakers are scrambling to reassert some semblance of control in the face of a challenge by a key military figure, General Khalifa Haftar. Among their proposals, the lawmakers are offering new elections meant to defuse tension. Forces loyal to Haftar, which overran Parliament Sunday, vow to press their fight against what they call an illegitimate government, its Islamist allies, as well as regional and al-Qaeda-affiliated militias. Colonel Wanis Bouhameda, who offered the support of his elite forces to Haftar's side Monday, issued a plea to what he called authentic revolutionaries for more help. Bouhameda said his special forces will join in the battle against current authorities until terrorism is stamped out. Fighting between Haftar forces and their rivals in the capital Tripoli and the eastern city of Benghazi has left at least 70 people dead since Friday. Military forces who remain loyal to Libya's current government pledged to fight back and ask for help from Islamist allies in order to support what they call the legitimate order. Chief of Staff General Abdusalam al-Obeidi urged that power be transferred in a legal and peaceful way, echoing calls for new elections. Most of Libya's many political and militia forces stake their claim to legitimacy on the uprising that forced longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi from power in 2011. No single force or coalition has been able to exert effective central control since. The unrest has prompted the U.S. military to increase troops and aircraft stationed in southern Italy in case U.S. personnel in Libya need to be evacuated. Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and other states have closed their diplomatic missions in Libya in recent days. In an interview with Ashraqa Aswat newspaper, Haftar said he's trying to rid Libya of the Muslim Brotherhood and accused members of the Islamist group in Egypt of fueling unrest in Libya. Egyptian police near the Libyan border say they have received orders to close the frontier until stability has been restored. Scores of Egyptian migrant workers have been kidnapped and held for ransom in eastern Libya in recent weeks. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
Malawians voted today in a poll where 11 candidates are competing to unseat President Joyce Banda, Southern Africa's first female head of state. As VOA's Lamek Masina reports, there were problems with the polling in parts of the main city, Blantyre.
Voting in Blantyre has been characterized by irregularities, often due to lack of voting materials such as ink pads. In other centers, the names of the presidential candidates were missing on ballot papers. This prompted people at two polling centers to vandalize ballot boxes and tear apart marked ballots. Police eventually contained the situation. Despite the anomalies, there has been a huge turnout, especially in rural areas. Gilbert Museliwa voted at the Goliath polling center in the southern district of Cholo.
I'm very excited to have cast a ballot for the leader I want to lead me after today. I've also voted for a ward councillor who is somebody with a clear vision of development. My expectation is that the new president should be able to do what people want, and that's the person that I voted for, and those are my expectations about the new leader.
Another voter, Gertrude Lungu, said the voting was peaceful but complained about the slow voting process.
The slowness is generally because of the lack of materials, because out of the 8 streams that they were supposed to have at this center, only 2 are operating, meaning that only 2 people are voting at a time against an expected 8.
A presiding officer at the center, Charles Tembo, said the problem has been communicated to Cholo District Commissioner, who assured them it would be sorted out as soon as possible. Malawi Electoral Commission officials told VOA that they are hoping to rectify all the polling station problems quickly. By law, election results are to be released within 7 days after voting. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Continued fighting and displacement in the Central African Republic has left tens of thousands of children abandoned and without the basic services to live. In addition, they are severely traumatized and in need of mental health care. One organization, SOS Children's Villages USA, is providing support and protection to these vulnerable children. The group is providing them with food, shelter, and protection, basically a home environment. They are also giving them much-needed mental health therapy. SOS says, due to the deteriorating situation in the CAR, children are showing signs of emotional trauma, such as night terrors and nightmares. Lynn Kromberger is CEO of SOS Children's Village USA. She talked to VOA's Kim Lewis about the need for mental health care for CAR's traumatized children.
At SOS Children's Villages, you know that we provide homes and families for orphan and abandoned children. In CAR right now, that means we're providing support to the children in our villages in Bangui and Bouar, as well as children who have been recently left without parental care. The children in our villages, as well as the children in the surrounding community, are experiencing a lot of trauma. They're having trouble socializing. They're not sleeping. They're having night terrors. They're witnessing some pretty horrendous sites at this point.
From the social perspective, can you give an example of how they're acting?
When we had a psychologist working with the children and they asked the children to draw their feelings, they're drawing photos with stick people with guns, they're drawing blood, they're drawing murder scenes. They're not drawing typical, you know, rainbows and butterflies like children normally would draw. They're witnessing some pretty horrendous sights firsthand.
Is this trauma affecting boys and girls differently?
Not to my knowledge. Right now we're seeing equal trauma across both genders.
What type of therapy are they undergoing to help them?
So we had a psychologist come in and work with the children on stress reduction, which again is just not something children their age should be experiencing. But it did help them in terms of sleeping, the drawing therapy. What we need is more long-term psychological support, and what we are going to be having is the psychologist working with our caretakers so that our caretakers can do a better job of recognizing trauma and learning how to deal with traumatic situations for these children.
I know you were talking about long-term therapy, so what exactly does that entail, especially if the fighting is continuing?
Yeah, I mean, that's the hard part. It's getting more psychological support, which is not something the government can provide right now. So first, we have to make sure the children are safe. So food, water, security, that's the first step. And then try to provide additional psychological support, not just from the psychologists themselves, but if we can train our caretakers and do a train-the-trainer model so that we can provide more consistent long-term psychological support in addition to the security. Those are things that will help the children in the long run.
Do you have enough support right now in terms of therapists and psychologists?
Not yet. That's one of the things that we're trying to raise funds for, so So if people want to help us, they can go to sosusa.org and make donations. We're working on this crisis as well as a lot of other crises right now where children are going through, unfortunately, a lot of these similar traumatic experiences.
What is the age range of the children that are receiving therapy right now?
We have children from 2, 3, up to 16, 17 years old. We take all children of all ages, all genders, all race, all ages.
What do you see ahead down the road for these children?
That's the critical point. I mean, if we can provide psychological support right now and try and help them deal with these situations so that it doesn't have as deep a long-term impact, that's our goal. Our goal at SOS is to help children who are already experiencing trauma because they don't have parents in their lives to be successful, happy adults at some point. When you have a crisis like this, that puts a lot of extra pressure on that goal because it's even harder. So we're doing what we can to make sure that we can still fulfill that mission, is to provide as much holistic support for a child to be able to lead a happy and successful life.
That was Lynn Kronberger, CEO of SOS Children's Villages USA. She spoke with Kim Lewis from their headquarters in Washington, D.C. You are listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. In Libya, rival factions battle for control of the fractured country. Malawians vote today in a poll where 11 candidates are competing to unseat President Joyce Banda. And continued fighting and displacement in the Central African Republic has left tens of thousands of children abandoned. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237. The world's largest gathering on HIV/AIDS will be held in July in Melbourne, Australia. The theme of the 20th International AIDS Conference, also known as AIDS 2014, is Nobody Left Behind. VOA's Jody Capua reports organizers have issued the Melbourne Declaration.
Since the AIDS Conference in Durban, South Africa in 2000, conference organizers have released declarations several months prior to the event. Chris Byrer is a professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and president-elect of the International AIDS Society. He says there are several reasons why declarations are issued.
Certainly the first is, as in the case with the Durban Declaration, that there are often compelling issues facing the field and facing everyone living with HIV and people working on HIV that really demand international attention. So the conference provides a platform, a spotlight on the global epidemic, and so we use the conference declarations to really highlight those issues.
The Melbourne Declaration affirms that non-discrimination is fundamental to an evidence-based, rights-based, and gender-transformative response to HIV and effective public health programs.
There has been a wave of new anti-gay discriminatory laws and policies in a number of countries. The recent laws in Russia, the new laws that were passed in Nigeria in 2013 and in Uganda just recently, which really are a threat to access to care for people living with HIV and for sexual and gender minorities more broadly.
AIDS 2014 organizers say such laws exist in over 80 countries.
The motivation for this current declaration is really to say the HIV response has always been about universal access, about non-discrimination, and about working with affected people and communities. That's always been who we are, and that's why we've had the successes that we've had. And so we're really trying to use the conference to highlight that we see these laws as really a dangerous trend in the wrong direction.
Many of the laws against gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgenders have their roots in colonialism. But Byers says the new law in Nigeria takes discrimination further.
It was not illegal, for example, to organize meetings, to have discussions, to do outreach for folks at risk, for gay and other men who have sex with men. The new law criminalizes all those behaviors. So, for example, makes it illegal to organize a public health meeting to discuss these issues. It makes it illegal to do outreach and provide services.
The effect, he says, is to quickly cut off access to life-saving HIV services.
Untreated HIV is still fatal. So when you talk about reducing people's access to care, this is not trivial. This is a life or death matter.
While the U.S., Great Britain, and others have moved toward expanding gay rights, including same-sex marriage, some former British colonies are going in the opposite direction. Some of the anti-gay laws have the support of American evangelical groups. One minister, Scott Lively, has been active in Uganda and Russia, for example. He's currently being sued in Massachusetts by an American group representing sexual minorities in Uganda. The suit accuses Lively of crimes against humanity. Lively's attorney says his client's preaching against homosexuality is protected by the U.S. Constitution. In 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down as unconstitutional what's known as the Anti-Prostitution Pledge, as it relates to U.S. NGOs. It required that NGOs receiving federal funds to combat HIV and trafficking adopt a policy opposing prostitution and sex trafficking. However, the Supreme Court said it violated the First Amendment right of free speech, but the ruling did not apply to foreign NGOs receiving such funds. The International Aid Society president-elect says many who sell sex do so consensually and consider it their everyday job. They oppose the anti-prostitution pledge. Professor Byra says the language surrounding the issue has caused problems.
We have had some conflation, I think, in language and terminology around, for example, trafficking of persons and sexual exploitation with sex work that I think, broadly speaking, has not been helpful in terms of trying to provide services to people and really understand, you know, who is a coerced person who really needs protection and who is a consenting adult who is choosing to sell sex.
He says when sex workers are organized and managers of commercial sex, they can actually help control the spread of HIV.
They do a very good job of promoting condom use, of STD care and treatment access. And when they're organized, this goes rather well. When you talk to the communities about what it is that they want sex work to be understood as work. They want access to care and services. They want to be able to be organized. And they, of course, want protection from violence, which is a major issue.
Instead, he says, crackdowns and exploitation drive sex work underground, where protection against HIV is lacking. There's no indication the anti-prostitution pledge will be repealed by the U.S. In 2016, the International AIDS Conference returns to Durban, South Africa. It was the first time the meeting was held in a developing country, and the last time it was in Africa. At the time, organizers issued the Durban Declaration, which said HIV caused AIDS. It was aimed at then South African President Thabo Mbeki, who had refused to accept that a virus was the cause of the epidemic. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In a keynote address to the World Health Assembly, Melinda Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, urged delegates to endorse the first global action plan to end newborn deaths. Lisa Schlein reports from the conference in Geneva.
Health officials agree that newborn deaths are preventable, yet nearly 3 million babies die each year within their first 28 days of life. Many do not even get a chance to draw a breath. The World Health Organization says 2.6 million babies are stillborn, and more than 1 million of those deaths occur during labor. Because of this staggering toll, Melinda Gates says she hopes WHO will pass the Newborn Action Plan by the end of the week. That way, she says, health ministers can immediately start the process of saving these young lives. At a news conference in Geneva, the philanthropist told journalists five low-cost interventions are very effective in saving newborns, including breastfeeding, methods of resuscitating newborns, preventing and treating infections, and so-called kangaroo care for premature babies. That technique involves prolonged skin-to-skin contact with the mother. Gates says Ethiopia, Rwanda, and Nepal are already applying these interventions with some success.
Simply by using the health care extension worker or health community worker platform that they've got and focusing on those newborn deaths, they've been able to bring down not just under five mortality, but newborn death rates as well. So we have those as models, and the other African nations and other countries around the world are looking at those three countries to learn what is actually possible by focusing on this.
Gates says Ethiopia's newborn death rate has gone down by 28% since it began focusing on this issue in the last 6 years. As part of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, great progress has been made in cutting maternal and under five child mortality. But WHO reports South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa have the highest numbers of newborn deaths every year, with India, Nigeria, and Pakistan topping the list. Gates says the issue of newborn deaths has been neglected as a consequence of focusing on maternal mortality. The lives of mother and child are inextricably linked. Nevertheless, Gates tells VOA, in a delivery situation, midwives or community health workers tend to focus on saving the life of the mother.
They've seen so many mothers die in childbirth, so they'll focus immediately and sometimes exclusively, unfortunately, on the mother until they've got her in a state of making sure that she's going to survive, and then they turn to the newborn. And so quite often you'll get in a situation where the newborn then is gotten cool over time. Sometimes they'll do wrong practices in some countries. They'll actually scrub the vernix off of the baby, which will introduce infection.
Gates says it is important to make midwives and community health workers understand they should focus on both mother and child at the same time. An analysis published by the British journal The Lancet shows that progress in reducing newborn mortality lags behind successful efforts to improve the survival rate for children under the age of five. In most regions of the world, more than half of all child deaths are among newborns. While saving newborn lives is a tender-hearted thing to do, The Lancet notes it also makes good economic sense. It says every dollar invested in newborn survival returns $9 in economic benefits. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhaib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah, now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent
to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @UpfrontAfrica. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. In Libya, rival factions battle for control of the fractured country. And continued fighting and displacement in the Central African Republic has left tens of thousands of children abandoned. Coming up, music from Ivory Coast, and in our feature segment, millions of bottles of drinking water creates a massive amount of trash in Juba, South Sudan. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the sunny side of sports, and here is VOA's Sunny Young.
Sporty greetings once again to our Voice of America listeners.
Voice of America!
Joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Hello from Washington, David.
Thank you, Sonny, from a very chilly Johannesburg. It's May and winter is coming very hard and fast on us here in South Africa.
David, big weekend of qualifying action in Africa for next year's Nations Cup tournament in Morocco. More than a dozen fixtures played across the continent. First off, David, how about the results?
Right, Sonny. Liberia won, the Lesotho 0. Kenya 1, Comore Islands 0. Madagascar 2, Uganda 1. Libya 0, Rwanda 0. Burundi 0, Botswana 0. Central African Republic 0, Guinea-Bissau 0. Swaziland 1, Sierra Leone 1. Tanzania 1, Zimbabwe 0. Mozambique 5, South Sudan 0. Mauritania 1, Equatorial Guinea 0. Namibia 1, Congo-Brazzaville 0. Sao Tome e Principe 0, Benin 2. And Malawi 2, Chad 0. A reminder, second legs, May 30, 31, and June 1. And the Seychelles received a walkover because Gambia have been barred from all CAF competitions for 2 years over age cheating.
Looking back at those results, David, what were the highlights for you?
Highlights, Sonny, and lowlights. Let me look at the lowlights first. A really disappointing number of goals. They were extremely scarce. Only 19 in 13 matches. That's an average of less than 1.5 a game. So those strikers need to sharpen up their boots. Maybe make a few phone calls quickly to Cristiano Ronaldo and get some advice. It's funny, isn't it, Sonny? You watch him on TV, he just makes it look so simple, so easy. And yet here we are in Africa, 13 African Cup of Nations qualifiers. I'd be looking for an average of about 2.5 to 3 goals a game. That's like 40 goals. But no, just 19. And of those 19, 5 came from Mozambique. Now, South Sudan, the newest nation in the world, they were making their Cup of Nations debut, but I'm afraid it was not one to remember. The Mozambicans were 3-0 up at halftime and eventually emerged 5-goal victors. For the record, Josimar, Mexer, Sonito with a brace, and Isaac were the Mozambique scorers. The big surprise, Sonny, came in Mahajanga, not a place we regularly mention on the sunny side of sport. That's a city in the north of Madagascar. It hosted Madagascar against Uganda. Now, Uganda are placed 18th in Africa on the FIFA rankings, and Madagascar are 50. And by my mathematics, that's a difference of 32 places. That's a huge gap. So I think it would be reasonable to assume that Uganda, even playing away, would win or at least draw. But the Malagasies had other ideas. Sonny, they scored 2 goals, were in the first 24 minutes. And I've got the names here in front of me, and I'm rather reluctant to try and pronounce them. They are so long. But let me try. The first one is Andriak Sima. I think I've got that one reasonably correct. The second one is a challenge. It's Andriam at Sinoro. Apologies to all our listeners in Madagascar if I haven't quite got those names right. Anyway, they scored. Madagascar missed a great chance to go 3-up midway through the second half. They missed a penalty kick. And then there was a penalty in stoppage time converted by Kiza for the Ugandan Cranes that made the final score 2-1. And my feeling, Sonny, is that that goal could well be crucial over the two legs. Remember, these matches are home and away. Uganda will host the second leg in 2 weeks' time. And a 1-0 victory for the Cranes at home would see them through on the away goal rule, although I'm sure their coach, Milutin Sredovic, a Serbian, he will want a much more convincing performance and a much bigger victory. But well done, Madagascar. I was speaking to the reporter who's at the match, and I was saying to him, Sonny, that what a wonderful story. It's been so long. It's such a rare occurrence. Madagascar have been going through some torrid times of late when it comes to international football. So well done to the Berea, as the national team are known. The Berea are a prized breed of cattle in Madagascar. I'm not sure quite what the connection between the cattle and the national team is, but that's what they're known as, and they've won by 2-1 against Uganda. Kenya, Sonny, I thought would beat the Comore Islands with several goals to spare. If you put a gun to my head, figuratively speaking, of course, I would have said maybe 3-0 for Kenya, but the Comore Islands did very well. They restricted Kenya to a 1-goal victory in Nairobi, a goal from John Omolo after 34 minutes. And that means that Kenya have got a tough task ahead. They've got to go to Moroni on the Comore Islands, which are off the east coast of Africa, off Mozambique to be more precise. And what I would have thought would be a fairly routine visit by the Kenyan Harambee Stars now looks like it's going to be a potential battle for survival. Another 1-0 win was by Liberia against Lesotho in Monrovia. Now, I know, Sonny, that your show has a big listenership in Liberia, in the heart of West Africa. And I say hi and good luck to the Lone Stars of Liberia. The goal coming from Lafour after 40 minutes. He is a player I know well. He plays for the South African champions Mamelodi Sundowns. So 1-0 to Liberia, and of course, like Kenya, they've obviously got some work to do. Yet another surprise, Sonny, in Tunisia, Libya 0, Rwanda 0. Now, Libya are ranked 12th in Africa, and Rwanda only 39th. So even though Libya had to forfeit home advantage because of the unrest in the country, and they played a match instead in Tunis, the Tunisian capital, I think it was fair to assume that the Libyans would prove too strong, remembering that this is the team that won the African Nations Championship just a few months ago. But we must salute Rwanda. They held firm, forced a goalless draw. They now will obviously fancy their chances in Kigali in the second leg. But another East African team that are in a less favourable position are Burundi. They were held 0-0 in Bujumbura by Botswana, who must now be favourites to win the return match. Another draw, Sonny, and also goalless, was Central African Republic against Guinea-Bissau. Now, Central African Republic in the same unfortunate position as the Libyans. Civil unrest in the country, so they could not use home advantage and had to play that match in the Congolese capital, Brazzaville. Swaziland were rocked at home by an early goal for Sierra Leone, but Shongwe equalised in the second half. Boko scored after 13 minutes to give Tanzania a 1-0 victory in Dar es Salaam over Zimbabwe. And the side, Sonny, we keep telling our listeners to watch out for Mauritania. They've won again, third victory in a row, remembering they beat Mauritius in the first round. Diakite, after 76 minutes, giving them a 1-0 victory over Equatorial Guinea. Another 1-0 home win was achieved by Namibia. Rudolf Bester scoring in the final minute to beat Congo Brazzaville 1-0 at the Sam Nujoma Stadium in Windhoek. A good away win for Benin, Sao Tome and Principe have proved tough customers in the previous qualifying tournament. But two goals from Sessegnon, that's the Benin midfielder who plays for West Bromwich Albion in the English Premier League. He scored after 80 and again after 90 minutes, this time from the penalty spot. So I think it's safe to assume that Benin will qualify. And if they do qualify, Sonny, they will face either Malawi or Chad. And two goals from Frank Mwango, one after 5 minutes and the other after 84, gave the Malawian Flames a two-goal victory in Blantyre before a capacity crowd at the Kamuzu Stadium.
David, earlier you were talking about Madagascar, and I remember last year during the Cup of Nations,
Voice of America,
you told our Voice of America listeners about another island team, Cape Verde, and how some of that team was made up of European-based players. How would you describe the makeup of Madagascar?
It's largely local, Sonny, but they do have some players in the lower leagues in France. And this is the big if they have the cash available, they will fly those players back. But, you know, Madagascar used to be quite a tough nut to crack at home. They've always struggled away. One of the problems with the Malagasy footballers are physically they're very small, they're very light, and the big powerhouses, the likes of the Nigerians and the Ghanaians and the Ivorians in West Africa, would tend to literally shove them out of the way. But on this occasion, Sonny, yeah, a great result to beat Uganda 2-1. And that puts quite a bit of pressure on the Ugandans. They didn't go as far as they hoped at the African Nations Championship in South Africa last January. They were eliminated in the first round, whereas I think the very least they expected was a quarterfinals place. And were they to fail against Madagascar over the two legs, then I think Shredovich would have to polish his CV, update it, get a couple of printouts done without any of the Ugandan football officials seeing him, and spread the word around that he might be available elsewhere. Uganda, Sonny, I think their bottom line would be to qualify for the group stage, nothing less. And that means beating Madagascar and then beating the winners between Mauritania and Equatorial Guinea. I think anything less than a group place, and the Ugandans would be very unhappy. They are desperate, Sonny, to get to the Cup of Nations. The last time they qualified was way back in 1978, when, to their credit, they reached the final and they lost 2-0 to the host nation, Ghana. But that's an awful long time ago, 1978. They're a proud nation, they love their football, but they just can't seem to crack reaching the finals of the Cup of Nations. And the last thing they want now is to be eliminated by Madagascar.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
VOA!
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. In our feature segment, the consumption of millions of bottles of drinking water in Juba creates a massive amount of trash in a city that has few options for recycling. And next, the United Nations has created a medal to be given to UN peacekeepers and civilian staff demonstrating great courage. But first, some music. Here is Bikiharmi Takri of Ivory Coast with Woody T.
I sene mutuake manyo kesu awolo chemia elale kudu babona nyezi petri agreke wanya nyende nami o anuna walio medu budu ayere nyao atole iagalo zeme itali wala modudu
Carmi Takri of Ivory Coast with Woody T. Clean drinking water is becoming increasingly hard to find in Juba, South Sudan, forcing most people to turn to bottled water. One local non-governmental organization says more than 1 million bottles are consumed every day in the country's capital, and that is creating a massive amount of trash in a city that has few options for recycling. Anthony Moga in Juba looks into one new initiative that is putting people to work.
About 20 kilometers outside of Juba, On the road to Yei, there is an enormous dam site. The trust flows across deep valleys in an area the size of 5 football pitches, and most of it consists of empty plastic water bottles, soda cans, and tires. An informal recycling program exists at the dam sites. Dozens of women and children show up each morning and dig through the trust to find plastic bottles and metal scraps items. 22 years old Esther Keji says she sells the items to traders from Uganda and Kenya to take the scrap back to their country for recycling.
This work is really hard. We are just working every day collecting the plastics and the metals. Sometimes one can get money. We are praying to God to find us nice jobs because here there is no benefit. We are just suffering every day in the sun without help.
Keji says the recycling cannot keep up with the amounts of trust piling up in Juba. She says she can see the dam site grows larger every day. Olivier Snowden, the program advisor for the local NGO Environmental Rehabilitation Program, says the amounts of trust could do serious harm to Juba's environment in the future.
This type of plastic bottles were only invented last century, so no one is able to really say how long it takes because we have no experience of it. But experts say that it takes maybe 1,000 years. So they will stay here. I mean, if you put a bottle in the ground today, the grandchildren of your grandchildren will find it there exactly in the same way. It will not decompose.
Snowden says about a year ago, they came up with the idea of recycling the discarded bottles and turn them into locally used items.
Recycling is really a good way also to prevent extracting more oil than we need. It's a resource here in South Sudan, and you can see, you visited the dumping site, you see how many people can make a living from extracting this instead of leaving it into the ground. We process it, it's turned into some cloth, it's turned into plastic ropes, at least it's got a second life.
Snowden machines at the plant in Juba convert the bottles into a number of different items. He says they are able to recycle 50,000 plastic bottles each day, which provide jobs for hundreds of women at the dump sites, including 31-year-old Victoria Alex.
They use a weight scale. We get paid £1 for 4 kilos of plastic bottles. We are benefiting because one cannot earn a living by staying in the house without doing anything. That is why we come here, so that we may be able to get a meal for our children.
Snowden says the women are not only helping their families, but everyone in Juba by reducing trash and creating something useful. For VOA News, I am Anthony Moga in Juba.
The United Nations has created a medal to be given to UN peacekeepers and civilian staff demonstrating great courage. The award honors Captain Mbaye Yagini, an unarmed Senegalese UN observer who saved hundreds of lives in the 1994 genocide and died in the line of duty. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports from the United Nations.
Captain Mbaye Diang distinguished himself during the dark days of Rwanda's 1994 genocide, in which Hutu extremists slaughtered some 800,000 people, mostly Tutsis, in just 100 days. The 36-year-old captain, husband, and father of two, was an unarmed military observer in the UN mission in Rwanda. Rwanda's UN ambassador, Eugene Gasana, said Thursday that in the face of evil, Captain Diang refused to be a bystander.
With no guns, no weapons, armed only with courage and sense of responsibility, Captain Diagne decided to conduct several missions, going through dozens of checkpoints held by armed militias to save hundreds, maybe thousands, of Rwandans during the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi.
On May 31, 1994, Captain Diang's work ended when a mortar round exploded at a checkpoint near his car. He was hit by shrapnel and died instantly. The Rwandan genocide was also a dark period for the United Nations and the international community, which failed to forcefully intervene to stop the killing. Jordan's UN ambassador, Prince Zayed Al Hussein, said the fact that no UN official at headquarters ever called the captain's family after his death can only be described as shameful.
I am absolutely sure everyone here would join me when I say we are sorry, profoundly sorry, for the way you've been treated by us here at the UN.
The award, to be known as the Captain Dieng Medal for Exceptional Courage, will be presented to UN military, police, and civilian personnel who demonstrate exceptional courage in the face of extreme danger while fulfilling the mandate of their mission in the service of the United Nations and humanity. The medal was established in a resolution put forward by Jordan and adopted unanimously by the UN Security Council on Thursday. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Lack of electricity is one of the great obstacles to development in sub-Saharan Africa. Nearly 70% of sub-Saharan Africans, some 600 million people, lack access to electricity, forcing them to spend significant amounts of their income on costly and unhealthy forms of energy, like diesel fuel to run factory generators and smoky and scarce wood for indoor fires for cooking. That is why last summer, President Barack Obama announced Power Africa, an initiative that will significantly increase the number of people with access to electricity in sub-Saharan Africa. Working with governments, international and African businesses, non-governmental organizations and institutions, including the World Bank, the European Union and the African Development Bank, the United States hopes to expand the capacity and reach of existing power grids and build mini-grids and off-grid systems to power Africa. By tapping many potential sources of energy, sun, wind, water, or heat from the Earth's core and Africa's abundant supplies of natural gas, the Power Africa initiative is already increasing power generation across the continent. To date, the U.S. government has committed more than $7 billion in financial support and loan guarantees, as well as coordinated support and expertise of 12 U.S. government agencies. The U.S. Overseas Private Investment Corporation, or OPIC, which mobilizes private capital to help solve critical challenges in developing countries, committed $1.5 billion to Power Africa for its first 5 years. The Millennium Challenge Corporation added another billion, and the U.S. Agency for International Development will provide $285 million. Today, Power Africa is set to clear the final hurdle, ratification by the U.S. Congress, where it enjoys strong bipartisan support in both chambers. Once it passes, it will be signed by President Obama. The electricity that allows businesses to flourish, clinics to store vaccines, and students to study long after dark will soon become available to more people living in sub-Saharan Africa. Power Africa will change their world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.